Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to look at Psalm 69, verses 1 through 18. This is one of the three most quoted psalms in all the New Testament. Does anybody know what the three most quoted psalms in the New Testament might be besides 69? They may quote that in New Orleans, but 110, 22, 69. 23rd Psalm's not quoted very much in the New Testament at all, if any, but I'm offhand. What did I say? Thank you. Why do you think those three psalms would be quoted more than any other? 110, 22, 69. Messianic psalms. 110 is the messianic implications of the pre-existent Christ. The Lord said to my Lord, "Sit thou at my right hand till I make thy enemies thy footstool." Psalm 22 is one of the most vivid descriptions of the crucifixion. And Psalm 69 has some very tremendous quotes in it. Now, the question arises, is this a typological psalm? Well, typology has been abused so badly, and by typology I mean finding something there that is not specifically there, but you feel like it foreshadows something in the New Testament. I have taken a rather cautious position on typology. I personally, it's just me, I'm not saying about you or what you need to do, I'm just saying for me and my prayer life and my study of the Bible, I recognize no types but those that are mentioned in the New Testament. And I just feel safer with that. I'm not saying there's not any more, I'm just saying for me and my house and my study, I recognize types that are listed in the New Testament. And therefore I don't see a whole lot of types everybody else seeing. But 69 is a limited type. And by limited, I mean it will not fit verse by verse. Matter of fact, even some major conceptions won't fit. But some really, really will. And some are so often quoted about Christ. Now, Psalm 69 is basically a psalm of rejection, a psalm of injustice, a psalm of reproach. At no cause except standing for God. Now, do you see with that how it could fit in with Jesus Christ, his trial before Pilate, his misunderstandings? So let's look at this, if you would. For the choir director, according to Shoshanim, and that's just the word for lilies, we don't know what that is exactly. I personally think it's either a musical tune or it is a type of musical accompaniment. Now, by accompaniment, I mean maybe certain instruments at certain times or certain groups of instruments, or maybe it's a melody. Many of our hymns have the same melody, though different words. This word lilies occurs in several other psalms, according to Lily. A psalm of David. Many folks do not like David being attributed this psalm because of the reference over in verse 35 to the cities of Judah instead of the cities of Israel. Paul, in Romans chapter 11, I believe verse 3, Romans 11, 3, I believe, quotes this psalm and says that David wrote it. Now, that can mean two things. That can mean that David wrote this section of the Psalter that it comes out of, or Paul can be saying David is the author. If I knew what Paul meant, my view of inspiration would say that I would agree with Paul. But since I'm not sure that's what Paul meant, then I'm just going to reserve my opinion and say I do not know who wrote this. It's, by the way, it's Romans 11:9. Okay? Now, let's look at this, verse 1 through 4. Let me read down through here and you follow along. Save me, O God, For the waters have come up to my soul. I have sunk in deep mire, and there is no foothold. I have come into deep waters, and a flood overflows me. I am weary with my crying. My throat is parched. My eyes fail while I wait for my God. Let's stop there for a moment. There's no way to understand this psalm unless we understand the literary metaphors connected with these words. You know, Bible study seems so academic and so scholarly sometimes today, but I want you to remember that if you were the Jew on the street, the Jew in Jerusalem, when this was written, there would be nothing in this psalm that you would have any problem understanding. It'd be your culture. It'd be your language. It was written for the man on the street. It was not written for the scholar. But difference of languages, the passing of hundreds and thousands of years, the difference of cultures causes great problems in trying to get back to what the author was trying to say to the people of his day. Now let's go back and try to fit as best we could what would a Jewish person have understood this author, this psalmist, saying when he said, for the waters, what? Do you remember some other passages in the Old Testament that talks about being overflowed, the waters getting deep, being mired down in the clay? Would you agree that's a pretty common metaphor, at least of the Psalms, at least of Jeremiah, at least of those two books specifically? If you had to define what you think waters would mean in your memory of reading the Old Testament, how would you characterize the concept of waters overflowing the person? Is it joy? It's distress, isn't it? And it's not minor distress, it's overwhelming distress and trouble and problems. So, right off the bat, we see that the psalmist is in straits. He's got some problems, he's got some needs, some things are happening he just can't understand. Now, Psalms 88:7 is another place that speaks about waters as overflowing someone. Now, my translation has, for waters, and we might just put problems, needs, have come up to my soul. Now, does anybody have the Revised Standard Version here tonight? RSV? Anybody? Excuse me. Gene, the word's neck there, isn't it? The waters have come up to my neck? Now, how can my translation say soul and your translation say neck? Well, let's think through this a minute. The word for soul is the Hebrew word nephesh. Now, nephesh can mean soul or it can mean breath. When God breathed into man the breath of life, and he became a living breath, a living soul. Breath, soul. There is an Akkadian word. Now, the Hebrew word here is the word nephesh or soul. But there's an Akkadian word that's very much like the word nephesh that means neck, throat. Why is the word soul and the word neck interchangeable for a translator? In a pre-medical society, where does the breath come from? So, there's no big problem between RSV and this. It's a derivation of the root word from nephesh, which has to be determined by the context, to neck. So, waters, and I think it's better, have come up to my neck. Doesn't that? You talk about, you know, we're just up to here with problems. That's exactly what the psalmist is saying to the people in his day, but he put it in different language. The waters have come up upon my soul. We would say, I'm up to here with it. Okay. Now, notice in verse 2. I have come into deep waters, and a flood overflows me. Are any of you afraid of water? Were you the child? My mother's afraid of water, and her fear of water, every time I'd get around a swimming pool, we used to live in Galveston, I remember as a child, don't you get close, scared me. I wasn't scared of the water, I was scared my mother scared me, you know, screaming at me, don't you do it. Like, you know, kid gets paranoid, just people screaming at him about don't get close to the water. My mother had some brothers who tried to teach her to swim by throwing her in some water. It petrified her. Now, folks, we live, I know West Texas is dry, but You get up in the airplane, there's pontoon lakes all over this land. You ever seen the airplane in the evening? We have a lot of water. We have a lot of swimming pools. We're a people that can travel. We're accustomed to water. But you take a Hebrew out of the desert land, and you start talking to a desert tribesman about drowning, you have just struck panic in his heart. Now, he didn't mind a sandstorm. He didn't mind getting kicked by a camel. But you drop him into some body of water, and you have scared him to death. It is something that's foreign to him. Do you know Jews never went into maritime trade because Jews never had ships? In Solomon's day, he rented sailors. Jews are not people who are ready to go to sea. That's why the story of Jonah is so amazing, that you can get a Jew on a boat in the first place and then have him volunteer to jump in, you know. When they said the water's overflowing me, I want you to just sense. Any of you who are afraid of water have ever been, I want you to sense that of panic that was gone through a Jew's heart when he heard that. Drowning, overflowed, caught in the torrent rain. Scared him to death. Scared him to death. Now, notice verse 3. I am weary with my crying. My throat is parched. Now, context-wise, let's look at the context, 1 through 3. Has he been weeping, and that's why his throat is hoarse? What's he been doing? This man's been praying out loud. And he's been praying out loud so long and so loud that he can hardly speak now. The Hebrew word here for the word, my throat is parched, the Hebrew word is my throat is fiery red, it's raw. I've prayed and I've begged and I've pleaded and I've cried and I still have no answer from heaven. You ever feel that way? Do you ever feel like you pray and cry and beseech God and you don't feel like He's heard a word? But I want to promise you something, fellow Christian. God's answer is not determined by whether we feel like He hears us. God's answer is determined by the book that promises that when God's children pray, God hears and acts. I was struggling with what I've been mentioning to you about, and I drove by the church down here, Tabernacle Baptist Church, one day. And they had a sign that I liked very much, and it said, God's answer is better than our prayer. The man's been praying and hadn't... Look what he says. My eyes fail me while I wait for my God. He's not giving up. But he just wants God to know he's getting a bit nervous. You know, he just wants God to know that, hey, I've been crying and begging here and you haven't done nothing. Now, surely you never feel that way. Verse 4. Those who hate me without a cause are more than the hairs of my head. There are some here who couldn't pray that prayer. Without a cause. Is there a messianic implication in people hating without a cause? It's down a little bit further where it says, what I did not steal, I have to restore. I think the thing that sticks in my throat most often in this life, the thing that's really hard for me to deal with and handle, the thing that still makes me extremely angry, is injustice. Obvious injustice. In the back of my mind, I wonder, God, are you sure you're going to level this out? This is so unjust and so unfair and so uncalled for and such ugly attitudes. God, this is so unjust. That sticks right there. Without a cause. Now, I want you to remember this in Oriental background. Judea is Oriental as far as its philosophy of life. For an Oriental person to experience shame and injustice, I don't know. I don't even know anything in our culture that could be like that. That is the epitome of having your feelings hurt. That is the ultimate of embarrassment for an Oriental person. We talk a lot about losing face as far as the Oriental expression. That's what we have here. Without a cause, they've done this. Many of them, numerous ones. Now, look, the second part of verse 4, my translation has, those who would destroy me are powerful. Now, I don't know why in the world that New American Standard left out a phrase. They left out a whole Hebrew phrase here.
Somebody read a different translation and see if we can pick it up in their translation. Gene, why don't you read RSV for me? Now, the word lies appeared in his. It did not appear in mine. Another translation, please. Just a little phrase. Okay. Is that King James? He left the phrase out too. The phrase that's left out in a lot of English translations is lying adversaries. Now, not only are they trying to destroy him, and not only are they powerful, but they're making up lies about him. Does that have a messianic ring to it about the trial before the Sanhedrin? Don't you know the thing that just really got Jesus was the people who had seen him heal, the people who had heard him teach, walked in there and said, he said, they knew, he knew, the Sanhedrin knew it was not true. Because they couldn't get two of them to agree on any one of the charges. And it doesn't say how many, but brought numerous ones in, trying to get two to agree. They couldn't even get the lies together. Okay? Now, verse 5 shows, I think, the problem of why this psalm can't be completely typologically messianic. Verse 5 will not fit in the life of Jesus, will it? Nowhere in the world verse 5 can fit the Lord Jesus. Even his baptism by John, which some of us struggle with. Why did Jesus undergo a baptism of repentance? That's what John's baptism was specifically stated for. It was a baptism of repentance to prepare the way for the Lord. Why did Jesus go through that? Did he have sin in his life and he had to correct? There's been lots of theories. He wanted to identify with sinful man. He wanted to affirm John's message. We just don't know why he did it. But I don't think that verse 5 can refer at all to John's baptism. It says, O God, it is thou that know my folly, foolishness, and my wrongs are not hidden from thee. This is, well, sometime in marriage problems, somebody will come in and I will hear a story that's just terrible. You just can't imagine how bad it is. But when you talk to the other person, it's amazing how different their perspectives are on what's happening. So often in the middle of injustice, we feel like we've been done bad and boy, it's not fair, they did this to me. And oftentimes we get so involved in the injustice, we forget that it takes two to tango. Often there's a bad attitude on our part that adds to the situation. David is saying, Lord, there may be something that I added to this situation of why they're hating me. I may not have been the king I should have been. I may not have counseled them. There may be something on my part, God. I'm not a sinless person. I have faults. Maybe I added to this, God, but you know my heart about this. You know. You understand me. So I think it's very significant that David here was admitting the fact that he had a problem. He wasn't saying, oh, I'm so innocent. I've never wronged. He's saying, God, I've done wrong too. And I think that's significant. Notice where it does seem somewhat unusual after verse 4 or 1 where it says, they hate me without a cause, and then for him to admit that he's sinned. But isn't that so true to life? Verse 6. By the way, notice where it says, God knows us, let us know my folly and my wrongdoings. Isn't it a beautiful comfort to know that God knows our sin and still wants us to be part of his family? God accepts us while we were still sinners. God loves us as much as he could love us in Christ Jesus while we were rebelling against him. It helps me to know that God knows my fault and still desires for me to come to live with him. Verse 6. And those who wait for thee, not be ashamed through me, O Lord, God of hosts, captain of the armies of heaven, is what that phrase means, that thou who seek thee may not be dishonored through me, O God of Israel. I want you to think with me what that psalmist is saying. I want you to write in your words, somewhere on that outline, a sentence to express what that psalmist is saying in your own words right now. Verse 6, I want you to write it in your own words what that psalmist is praying. We don't have long now, so you only got a minute or two. When somebody gets that done, tell me what you've written. Anybody got it finished? David? Okay. Somebody else? Yes. Godly witness. I don't think we know how many folks are looking at us. This was David. He was king of Israel. He's saying, God, by the way I act, don't let anybody be turned away from you. I want to tell you, that, not those words, and I haven't ever seen this before, but that has become a prayer of my life. I no longer pray for the truth anymore. I don't pray when I do a sermon or when I study. God, give me the truth. I think that's arrogant. First place, that means my interpretation is God's interpretation? Never, 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 never. But what my consistent prayer is that I will never do anything or say anything that will turn somebody away from Jesus Christ. That's a pretty good prayer. And I think all of us need to pray something like that. Because all of us are false. All of us have problems in our lives that are obvious to other people and not obvious to us. And I think the beautiful prayer of a sincere Christian is, oh God, faulty though I may be, help me not to keep anybody else from you. Now, I want to say also here how great a witness it is for a Christian to endure hardship in love. The great testimony as far as a witness is not in times of prosperity. I made $10 million and God did it. The great testimony is I lost $3 million and God's still with me. Success sometimes is hard to handle. But the world can be successful. But the world does not know the ability in the midst of terrible frustrations and problems to have great faith in God. Now, lifestyle is important. I think that's a beautiful, beautiful verse there, verse 6. Don't let me stand in others' ways. Let me be a godly witness. Both good things. Verse 7. Because for thy sake I have borne reproach. What does that mean? If it was David, what was he bearing reproach for? Now here again is the messianic implication. Christ bore the hatred of the world, not for himself, but for who? For God. Christ bore the hateful reproach of the world against its creator. He said, because I love God and have preached His word and taught His word and done His thing, the world has hated me. It's exactly what David's saying. They have hated me for your sake. For your sake, God. Now, whether that means that everybody knew he was a man of prayer, a man of faith, and they were saying, we don't need a man of prayer, we need a man of action. You ever heard that? Why don't you do something? Now, exactly what they were approaching him for, we don't know. We get some little pointers a little later, but what exactly, we don't know. Matthew 5, 10 through 12 came to my mind. That's part of the Sermon on the Mount. And notice, let's just look at that real quickly. For sometimes we feel like that when we get in trouble for our own stinkiness and we say, oh, I'm a Christian, I'm being persecuted. No, ain't no good if you've been a stinker and get caught in it. The whole deal about being persecuted for righteousness' sake is you've been a great person, a good person, a loving person, a kind person, and now you're getting in the neck because you know Jesus. Now that's what it's talking about. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Now, going down to, again, look at the dishonor has covered my face. Remember the oriental background and what that meant to them. It would probably not mean the same thing to you. Verse 8, I have become estranged from my brothers and an alien to my mother's sons. All brothers here could meet a family group. It probably means national group, my kinsmen, as far as a national entity. But when it says from my mother's sons, in a day when there were many wives, other sons or daughters of the same mother had a unique relationship, a closer relationship. And even that relationship has been broken here. Okay? Now look at verse 9. For the zeal for thy house has consumed me. That thing is quoted all through the Synoptic Gospels in John. Quoted in John very early in the cleansing of the temple, and quoted in the rest of the Synoptics at the cleansing of the temple at the end of Jesus' ministry. The zeal for thy house has consumed me. The word consumed literally means in Hebrew to be eaten up with. It speaks of priority relationship. The psalmist's commitment to God and his house was such that nothing else in life took priority over the love and compassion that he had for that place. I wonder sometimes if we could really structure our lives according to priority, what would be on top? And the reproaches of those who reproach thee have fallen on me. That also is quoted numerous times in the New Testament, especially the book of Romans. When I wept and my soul was fasting, it became my reproach. And when I made sackcloth my clothing, I became a byword to them, a parable to them. And those who sit in the gate talk about me, and I am a song of drunkards. What were they talking about? Well, that religious fanatic, you ain't getting down. He's up there fasting. He's up there praying. He's up there with sackcloth and ashes. They were making fun of his expressions of religious commitment. Weeping, fasting, and sackcloth are three signs, outward signs, of mourning in the Old Testament. The more he tried to be pleasing to God, the more these people made fun of him, and not behind his back, but in public place. For the word, those who sit in the gate, are the Old Testament way of saying the town leaders, the town elders. It'd be kind of like us put it in the AJ in the section of public notices. That's the closest thing I can get to in our culture. When it says, and I am a song of drunkards, they've kind of made a little song about those guys who hang around the taverns, and they are singing about David and his religious ridiculousness. The word drunkards here is literally the Hebrew word strong drink. It's interesting in the Bible, the word strong drink is always differentiated from wine. Let me give you a couple of references. Leviticus 10:9, Numbers 6:3, Deuteronomy 16:26. I don't know exactly what strong drink is. I have always thought that it was wine mixed with other ingredients, other kinds of hops or grains or something to make it stronger. But we really don't know the background of this word and can't be exactly sure what it is. Chrysostom said that it was palm juice. Well, I guess you get pretty wild on palm juice. I don't know, but we just don't know exactly. And notice verse 13. But as for me, my prayer is to thee, O Lord, at the acceptable time. The Jewish rabbis say this means you need to pray on Saturday at the synagogue. Is that what this is talking about? I don't think so. I think David's saying, God, I'm in a hurry. I wish you'd do it right now, but I want you to know, God, that whenever you're ready, I'm ready for you to do it. When it's right for you, God, I want you to act on my behalf. That'd be a good prayer for us, wouldn't it, to pray? God, according to thy will and in thy time frame, O Lord, hear my prayer. Could it be the other missing element in our prayers is not only the will of God, but the timing of God? Notice O God, in the greatness of thy loving kindness. The word loving kindness used here and used down in verse 16 is a very, very special word in the Old Testament. It's often translated in the King James mercy. It is a word that has tremendous implications for the covenant people. It is almost the Old Testament equivalent to the New Testament agape love. It is only used for God's covenant people. I usually translate it in my Bible when I read it to myself. God's unconditional covenant love. He made a promise to Israel, and he's going to keep it because of who he is, not because of Israel's obedience or disobedience. Unconditional covenant love. Answer me with thy saving truth. Deliver me from the mire. Let me not sink. I may not be delivered from my foes and from the deep waters. May the flood of water overflow me. Back to these metaphors of water again. Problems, needs. May the deep not swallow me up, and may the pit not shut its mouth over me. Now, the word pit here is used mostly in Hebrew for deep, deep water. A well. The ocean. But I think here, because of the use of the term, I think it's a way of talking about Sheol. Sheol was pictured as something that had a mouth and swallowed people. In our culture, the closest thing I know to it, have you ever heard death called the Grim Reaper? Picture of someone walking through a wheat field indiscriminately cutting wheat? Well, they had the same picture of an animal just gulping people up. And that's the picture of closing the mouth over me. I think it's a Sheol, place of the dead. Answer me, O Lord, for thy loving kindness is good. According to the greatness of thy compassion, turn to me. He's saying, God, act because of who you are. Act because of your loving kindness. Act because of your compassion. Act because of your, not because of my worth, because of who you are. Do not hide thy face from thy servant, for I am in distress. Answer me quickly. Isn't that just like a, God, I'm willing to wait for your time period, but oh, hurry up, time period. God, give me patience and give it to me now, right? That's just so human, it's beautiful, isn't it? God, when you're ready, I want you to answer it. But if I have my druthers, I wish you'd be right now. Just like us. Now, notice where it says, oh, draw near my soul. The word draw near is a cultic term for man approaching God with a sacrifice and being accepted. And here man is calling on God to approach him. Draw near to my soul and redeem it. This is a beautiful Hebrew word. This is the Hebrew word goel. Goel. It's usually translated the kinsman redeemer. And the perfect example is the book of Ruth. Boaz was Ruth's kinsman redeemer. Now the beautiful picture here is that God acts for us as a relative. God is saying, I'm your closest relative, and I will act on your behalf, and I will deliver you. And look at the next word. Redeem it, goel, and then there's the word ransom. Now, the word ransom is a word that means to buy something back by paying a price. The kinsman redeemer has to give something. What does he give? Well, here, it's not the medieval concept of the devil paying the devil for, God paying the devil for ransoming man. None of that. The price here is God's personal activity in our lives. The price that God pays is being involved with us on a day-by-day personal level and acting on our behalf. Redeem and ransom, two beautiful words of redemption, because of my enemies. All right. These are used together, by the way, in Isaiah 35, 9, and 10. If you'd like to see where they're used together again, they're often linked together because of their twin concepts. Questions or comments? Why is this psalm so important? Why was this psalm quoted so often in the New Testament? What's the element here that's so unique and quoted so often? Didn't you pick it up? Innocent suffering on behalf of God's namesake. Why was David suffering? He was suffering, apparently, at least in his mind, not because of what he had done, But he was suffering because he had a special relationship with God and was being persecuted because of that. And then 3 and 4, I think I've answered pretty clearly. Yes, Phil. Yes. I don't know where it is. Psalm 73 is the other psalm of injustice. Why the wicked prosper, and then the book of Job. Sounds like Job more to me, though, doesn't it? You ever ask that question to God when you see people who act so ugly and so hateful and so devious, and they succeed and you don't? Does that ever cross your mind? God, are you really in control? Do you really care? Is this all just a make-up deal? How can they be so evil and get to where they are? And I think God would say in loving kindness, they haven't got there yet.
Are you interested in verse-by-verse, in-depth Bible study? I would like to introduce you to the International Teaching Ministry of Dr. Bob Utley. Bob has been a pastor and evangelist for 20 years. He still conducts yearly evangelistic crusades around the world. He is now a Bible professor at a Christian university in Texas. His area of academic specialization is biblical interpretation. He combines academic credibility with evangelical zeal. A free catalog of Dr. Utley's teaching ministry of over 3,000 audio and video cassette tapes on a chapter-by-chapter study of the Bible, as well as difficult and controversial subjects, is available free upon request. Write today for your free catalog. Bible Lessons International, Box 1289, Marshall, M-A-R-S-H-A-L, Marshall, Texas, 75671.
But this says, received gifts from men, and Paul said, gave gifts to men. Now, did Paul change? Did Paul alter for his own purposes the Old Testament text? I've been told that for years. And before I had the capacity to look it up for myself, I had to believe those folks. That is not true. The Hebrew text does have the word received, and so does the Septuagint. And following that, the American Standard Version. But the Peshitta and the Chaldee and a Targum have the word gave. That means there is excellent ancient tradition for an alternate rendering of this verse. Not new rendering, ancient. Man, the Targums are old. The Chaldee is old. The Peshitta is all first century, right around there, Aramaic, not real old. But the other ones are much older, and they have the word gave. Now, that tells me to deviate from that Hebrew text. Those ancient manuscripts had another source. So Paul was picking up, I think, on a valid source, just different from the Masoretic text. Now, notice where, let's see. The idea here is God as the one who has all the gifts, and he gives them to men. Notice where it says, even among the rebellious also the Lord God may dwell there. That verse ought to hit you square in the face. I just said in the first part of this saying that the wicked would perish before God as smoke in the wind. They would perish before God as wax before heat. God would destroy those who are unrighteous. And look at this verse. Even among the rebellious also, the Lord Yahweh, covenant name, God, Elohim, may dwell there. This is what I think Psalms 139 picks on, that even in Hades, God is there. You can't flee from God. Even those who don't know him can't get away from him. This, to me, is the Old Testament idea that even when the end of time is over and time is no more, and man are separated as sheep and the goats, and we've gone to our eternal destinies, I want you to know the presence of the Maker will be with those he loves in hell, though they will not be able to know him and have fellowship with him. But God will be there weeping, because God will never leave his creation. And this world belongs to him, every part of it. Hell is not a concept that we can rejoice in about God getting rid of the wicked. Hell is a concept that is a bleeding sore in the heart of God forever, simply to give you a free choice to choose him and know him. Verse 19 begins, I think, it's what would be in the present, God's present care for us. Verse 19 through 23. And here we have, blessed is the Lord who daily bears our burden. My soul, what a verse! Jesus hit it on the head when he said, give us this day our daily bread. We're all the time wanting God to give us the full blueprint of life. We're wanting all the time to want to know next year, next month, next day. If that's not true, why are we gone so bananas in the book of the Revelation, so bananas in the book of Daniel, so bananas on horoscope, palm readers? People are crazy about the future. God will give you what you need one 24-hour period of time. And he'll not only give it to you one day at a time, but this is so staggering. He says, I'll become the donkey to carry your burdens, and I'll take them off you. Or it's either burdens in the sense of sins and problems and needs and that kind of thing, or it's that God's saying, I'll bless you so much that you won't be able to carry it, and I'll even carry what you can't carry that I give you over and above what you can even carry yourself. It's either God carrying our problems or God carrying our blessings, because he's given us so much we can't even carry them ourselves. My soul, what a verse. Blessed be the Lord who daily bears our burden. Blessed be the Lord who daily bears our burden. Matthew 6:11. Now that the next two verses go together, it's unfortunate we have a translation. And as you know, these verse divisions are not inspired. They were done in the 9th century A.D., or the 11th or the 12th, I forgot when. I think the second part of 19 ought to go with verse 20 for their parallel. Hebrew does not rhyme Hebrew thought patterns together. The God who is our salvation, the God is to us a God of deliverance. Just look at history. Look what God did to the nation of Israel and is still doing. And look what God's done in your life. Don't you think an appropriate title for our God is the God of our salvation, the God of our deliverance? Well, I do. Next verse. And to God the Lord belong escape from death. Well, the Hebrew here is to God belongs the issues of death. Now, here's, I want real quickly point out, and I won't get through, and I'm going to quit at 8. Ta-da-da-da. Rabbinical hermeneutics is so different from us that we often balk at them and say, oh, you're just a bunch of nuts. I feel close to that, but not completely. They have a theory that's getting real popular in the Christian church today. As a matter of fact, I've ran across four people in Lubbock who have really gone bananas in this system of interpretation. You put the alphabet down, and you put the numerical equivalent of the alphabet, A is 1, B is 2, C is 3. Or maybe A is 100, B is 200. Or maybe A is 50, B is 100. And then you add up the numerical equivalents of words. And then you can change words that have the same numerical equivalent. We get some of this in the word what? 666. That's a lot that people are doing it on. So the Jews got this word issues. And it has 903 numerical values. And so the interpretation of this passage from rabbinical theology is there are 903 ways to die. The worst to them is the croup. And the least to them is the kiss of God. They would say that when Aaron went up on the mountain and Moses went up on the mountain later, that God kissed them and they died. They get that from the word mouth in that passage. But anyway, isn't that interesting how they would do that? Now, that is so against my grain of the historical grammatical method of interpretation. But that's what rabbinical theology would do with that. I think that what we could say from a Christian point of view is that death is in God's hands, not the evil one's hands. Remember what God said to Satan? You can do what you want to, but don't kill him. Folks, the evil one doesn't take our life. Now, he can tempt us so bad that we take our own and destroy our own, but the evil one does not have the power of death. He just gets us to destroy ourselves. Surely God will shatter the head of his enemies. Okay, come on, prophets. Where have you heard that before? Shatter the head. Where? The first messianic promise. Where is it? What was that promise? He'll bruise your heel, but you will, it says, smite his head. It's the word crush, smash. It's the word of, I used to have some friends that had a fish pond in the backyard, and they were so mad that frogs would get in there because they have tadpoles. And I'd come home with him at night, and he'd see those frogs, and he'd just, oh, it just made me sick for hours. You big old bullfrog, that's the word here. Hits that head, the skull smushes, just flat. All over that snake or whatever else it is. That is what God's going to do to his enemies, I want to tell you. I'm glad you already threw eating, but notice here where it says, the hairy crown of him who goes on in his guilty deed. What is a hairy crown? Are there any rednecks here? I want you to know in Deuteronomy 33:42. It says the prominent people, I want to get this right,